Hello, my name is Peter Hasty, and you are listening to The Best Policy, the new podcast from the publishers of The Insurer. This is the second half of our interview with industry entrepreneur Stephen Catlin. And I'll start by asking what he estimates the ultimate cost of the industry could be from the coronavirus.
The industry has not covered itself in glory in recent weeks in its public proclamations. They've been defensive, ill thought through. And so often the case in this type of situation, it's not so much what you say, it's how you say it that counts. And how you say it has been completely neglected, frankly, which is why when you rang me and said, I'm not prepared to talk about this subject, I said, yes, in principle I am, because in a sense I don't want to because it's so uncertain, obviously. But in another sense, I'm so appalled about how we as an industry have communicated thus far. I frankly feel duty-bound to put my head above the parapet and be counted on it. So we can't change what's happened in the last few weeks. It's happened. But we can change the way we behave going forward, which goes straight back onto the next part of your question, I think, which is why, and to what I said at the beginning, that I think if we get them to the front foot and start being considerate, thoughtful, structured, helpful to governments, quite quickly we can turn that around. But if we don't do that, frankly, more fool us.
What might the danger be if we don't get on the front foot, Stephen? I mean, what do you think some of the outcomes could be if the industry maintains this defensive stance?
Well, if you were to take an extreme view, it'll take the industry out, because the potential aggregation of loss, as I said before, is way ahead of the total market cap of the P&C industry worldwide. And if we're not on the front foot, we're not being constructive, I think governments could well say, do you know what? I don't care if they go under. They're not providing service. Who needs them? Now, actually, that would be short-sighted for a government to say that, because there's so many parts of our lives that do need, like you can't drive a car without third-party liability. You can't go on a plane without third-party. You can't employ somebody without. You know, so there's a lot of insurance product, which if it wasn't there, would change the way the world worked negatively, and would actually give governments much bigger headaches than they're talking about now. So it actually is not a very wholesome remark to make, but if you want to get cheap publicity and you want to have a pop at an industry which you think hasn't reacted in the appropriate manner at a time of need, why wouldn't you try and take them out?
Yeah.
So I mean, I'm not suggesting that, and actually it's going to happen, common sense will prevail, but it'd be quite nice to see common sense prevailing today.
I mean, as you say, it's not a likely scenario, but I mean, but it is a possibility, do you think, Stephen, if the industry doesn't start engaging?
I think that the cost to the industry will increase substantially. I think the only person who's going to win under those circumstances will be the plaintiff bar, and they will win hands down. I mean, they're like beef on the honeypot at the moment, frankly. I find it hard to believe that the government would let the industry be taken out completely for reasons I've just given. But I think it could, that governments could allow an industry to absolutely put it down onto its knees. And I think under those circumstances, raising new capital could be quite challenging. I mean, we're going to be very interested to see what happens in the next 12 to 18 months, because there will be a shortage of capital, without doubt. I wouldn't like to say how much, but it'll be meaningful. And what is the appetite of investors going to be? Are they going to go in for deeply discounted rights issues? Are they going to encourage M&A and consolidation? Are they going to walk away? Or are they going to look for opportunities like Convex provides, which is something with a clean balance sheet? You know, there's quite a number of outcomes there, and I wouldn't like to predict exactly how it works.
If you were to be drawn on trying to get a quantum of what you think the virus will cost the industry, in the same way that you've perhaps estimated the potential US casualty impact to come, I mean, what kind of range would you be forecasting?
Do you know, Peter, I just don't know. Me commenting on casualty was predicated on 45 years in the marketplace, watching cycles, watching settlements change, whatever. I had quite a lot of data to, even though it wasn't necessarily bang up to date, to actually create some judgments on that, which I could then rationalise if anybody asked me the question. On this, I couldn't begin to do that. And part of it is going to be dependent upon how much governments pay small businesses, actually. I mean, what governments are trying to do is get some of the costs that they know they're going to, the checks they're going to write out, back from us lot. That's what the game is. And, you know, in the UK, what he said $330 million so far, and he said it's going to take 2 decades for that to be paid back. That's quite a substantial cost to the society. If he's saying 330 now, my guess is it will creep up to nearer 500. On that basis, a 30-year payback, which is substantial, actually, if you think about it. How much of that could be thrown at the industry? I haven't got a clue. But if you think about where the UK is in the geography of the world and where other governments are paying out relative monies of like kind, you're talking about $5,000 billion globally. You don't have to have a big percentage of that for it to be quite expensive to the industry. But I mean, to put a number on it is impossible. I think what you can say is that the downside risk is substantial and way beyond the industry's ability to pay.
A technical internal industry question quickly, Stephen, is that we saw reinsurers trying to implement COVID-related exclusions on the 1-4 renewal if they succeeded. Do you think this might be a bigger issue at the US mid-years?
I mean, in a perfect world, it's the direct underwriter that should deal with the coverage issues, not the reinsurance underwriter, really. Otherwise, you've got the tail wagging the dog. And if I wear a reinsurance hat, I want to know that I'm insuring the right direct underwriter who's thinking hard about the coverage he's giving and making certainly charging for it and aggregating for it. Whether or not you get standard exclusions in reinsurance contracts going forward, I don't know. It's certainly a possibility. I think that you've got to quantify it and price it. And at the moment, it's not quantified nor priced. And therefore, it is uninsurable and unreinsurable in the present construct. It's a bit like, you know, post 9/11. I should be writing our first terrorist policy 2 days afterwards at about a $1.50 rate when a week before I was getting the full property for a 15 cent rate. All of a sudden, things changed completely out of any kind of normality. And it was a recognition that we had a risk there which we hadn't recognized, we hadn't priced and hadn't aggregated. It was a problem. And that was the whole market. And to some extent, we're in the same boat here. So, I mean, I do think there's similarities between 9/11 and today. You had a bad casualty market then with the market turning already. The fact that that was a terrorist act and this is a pandemic, I'm not sure that's that relevant when you look at what's going to happen to the marketplace. The effect is not dissimilar, only other than to say that actually the pandemic is a bigger loss than 9/11 was. We know that already.
In 2001, after 9/11, we saw a spate of runoff as a shock of World Trade Center-related losses, weak investment markets, and casualty under-reserving combined to create a toxic combination. And do you foresee similar outcomes from the COVID-19-related crisis?
Look, I don't know, Peter, but what I would say to you is I do think there's some fundamental similarities between the two situations. Causation different, but output similar. The difference being this is a bigger loss than 9/11 was, so it would be natural to expect of the effect on balance sheets post 9/11 could well be amplified this time around.
I mean, it's a Janet and John question, but presumably, Stephen, what you're referring to there is both the economic impact on industry's balance sheets combined with liability losses. Is that the combination of the two will cause a shortage of capital? Is that your view?
Yes, I mean, I think post my time bomb, which I dropped in November, I think actually now the casualty issue, not necessarily because of me at all, but it now being spoken about openly, recognised openly by all interested parties. And again, nobody actually knows how big that issue is, but we know it's big. And people coming back to me, post my comments, nobody said to me, it can't possibly be 100 billion. And one or two people said, you may have understated, it might be worse than 200 billion. Well, I don't know. My view was that was a pretty large range. And from a common sense point of view, looks like that's the kind of hole we've got. Now, were we to get a bad cat year this year, on top of that, on top of the cost of the virus, there is definitely a capital shortage. And there's absolutely for sure a cash flow challenge. And even without a NatCat, actually, the two substantial problems, I mean, I keep saying in Kearney at Congress, we've got to remember just how fortunate we are. And we can't claim it was down to us being brilliant. It was actually, frankly, pure luck. We chose quite well when to start in Italy. We read the tea leaves on the county market, but we had no concept of what might happen with the pandemic. And as I said before, you know, we can spend 80% of our time looking forward, whereas most CEOs are spending 80% of their time looking backwards. And I said that actually just talking about casualty. If you add the virus on top of that, a lot of CEOs have got some quite substantial challenges. And I don't want to lord it over them any shape or form, but it could well have been me if we'd started earlier.
The industry is always vulnerable to being a political football that can be kicked by headline-seeking politicians. But is there a concern that results in 2020 will provide them with ammunition? After all, auto or motor is the largest P&C class by a distance, and cars off the road inevitably mean much lower loss experience. In the UK, that's probably going to be compounded by the forthcoming reform of the whiplash damages. The outcome could be the best underwriting result for motor or auto insurers for a decade or more. Is that going to be a problem for the industry?
If you think about it, actually, the question applies to other things as well, like aviation. Most airlines, not all, but most airlines have an adjustable rate based on number of flights flown, in which case, de facto, their premium comes down if they're not flying. Some don't, but they'll get negotiated downwards. So the aviation market, having expected a substantial increase in premium volume to pick up the shortfall of the last 3 or 4 years, is going to get the rate on exposure that it wanted, but not the premium volume. There isn't the activity. So that leaves that part of the industry with a bigger headache than they had beforehand, in some ways. I don't think the world's going to be the same when we get through this as it was beforehand. I think there's some changes that are going to occur, and occurring, which are there for good. Some of that's going to be for the good, some of it won't be so good. But certainly use of technology is going to get enhanced in how we look at life. And that will apply specifically to motor insurance. Do you remember we were seed capital for Box IT?
Yeah.
That one which drive like a girl and all that stuff? One of the more competent telemetrics at the time. And that in itself transformed the way you could look at motor. Because you could actually tell with a 95% certainty from the data what gender the driver was. It's extraordinary.
Yeah.
And when somebody claims whiplash and they actually it happened at 2 miles an hour, you know there wasn't any whiplash.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's already changing. But I think that what will happen going forward, I don't write motor, but if I was a motor underwriter, I'd be scratching my head very quickly now and say, right, I now need to change the way I charge and charge for the days driven, the hours driven, and charge for when it's night driving or whether it's daytime driving. You know, all that data is potentially available to the motor underwriter and he can charge accordingly. And then if he did that, then he wouldn't be making a huge amount of money this year, because he would have got insurance and not driving the car. Now, it's again an example of why it's important for the industry, I think, to look forward prospectively quickly to deal with the issues going forward, and then we can worry about the past after the event. It'll come through. But you are right. If the motor insurers just carry on as they've always have done, there's going to be an uproar. And you know what? The policyholder's got a point. Why is it I'm paying the same amount of money when the government stopped me driving my car for half the policy year?
Stephen, thank you very much. That draws to an end the second half of our first ever guest interview on Best Policy. Look out for our second guest who joins us after the Easter break. But for now, Best Policy is signing off. Goodbye.